This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
For daily content, follow Bartholomew Town on Instagram and TikTok. As Rhode Island's first ever member-owned credit union, Navigant Credit Union has been a staple in the local business community for more than 108 years. Today, Navigant is a $3.4 billion institution serving more than 136,000 members across 25 physical branch locations. But since its founding in 1915, the mission has never changed. Navigant Credit Union's team of financial professionals have remained committed to improving the financial well-being of the families, businesses, and communities they serve across Rhode Island. Learn more at NavigantCU.org.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.
Great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Lots going on right now. You held a roundtable that was really interesting. I wish I could have been there. I was on the radio as it was taking place, but the theme was really protecting our democracy. And it was a roundtable with Representative Benny Thompson. And that's such an important theme right now. There's so many layers to that. And for those that weren't able to attend the conference, or really, I guess most people weren't obviously able to attend, but most people who don't know what happened there and sort of this roundtable and the theme, give us the overview on protecting our democracy from your standpoint.
Yeah, thank you. So this all starts with January 6th, 2021. That was the day when a violent mob stormed the Capitol to try to stop votes from being counted and trying to stop Joe Biden from being named the president. And this mob was not random. They acted at the direction of Donald Trump. He lied to people, claimed that he won the election when he knew that he didn't, and then did nothing while this violent mob attacked the Capitol and people died. And this is the first time in our nation's history when that we've had a president who has refused to abide by the peaceful transfer of power and refused to abide by the will of the voters. And we cannot normalize that. We cannot look past it. And by the way, this is not behind us. Just today, the news broke that, you know, Donald Trump has installed his daughter-in-law to be the chair of the Republican Party, and they fired everybody. And now that they're hiring up again, one of the questions in the interviews is, you know, are you willing to say that the 2020 election was stolen? So Donald Trump continues to push these conspiracy theories and try to undermine our democracy. And so this is an important issue. This is going to be one of the most defining issues of our generation, is whether we save our democracy or not. So I invited Benny Thompson to come to Rhode Island. Benny Thompson was the chair of the January 6th committee. You remember a couple of years ago, they launched an investigation. They did a terrific job. It was televised. He was the chair. Liz Cheney was the vice chair. It was a bipartisan committee, Republicans and Democrats, trying to get to the root of what happened on that day. In a nutshell, you know, their main conclusion was that this was not a random group of people that just happened to, you know, riot and things got out of hand. This goes directly to the White House and to President Trump, lying to people and directing people to try to stop the transfer of power from happening. And so I invited Benny Thompson to come to have a conversation here in Rhode Island about what we can do to protect our democracy and defend it. And, you know, it's not rocket science. We need people to participate in the political process. We need leaders to tell the truth to the voters about the integrity of elections. But you know, this is going to be one of the defining issues of our generation. And so I wanted to make sure that we continue to not lose sight of it.
There's such a reverberation on this issue that it's almost shocking how there are still some folks who are just either completely or partially unwilling to accept the facts surrounding January 6th. In fact, I moderated a roundtable this weekend, or I should say I moderated a book talk with Ken Block former gubernatorial candidate, actually a former Republican, founder of the Moderate Party. And he was one of the people contracted by the Trump campaign to find instances of voter fraud. And the title of his book is Disproven. It was largely, in fact, probably entirely a room of people who would agree with that notion that there was no widespread voter fraud for a variety of different reasons. At the same time, when announcing this roundtable on X or in person, the amount of messages or people that pushed back and said, well, you know, I'm just part of the deep state that is trying to shield the public from the reality that, you know, the Biden administration rigged the election. It's still out there. And it is extremely concerning, and it is extremely disruptive, not only to democracy, but on a micro level, Republicans. I mean, how are Republicans to move forward with any sort of real debate, inter-party debate, with this clouding their environment?
Yeah, because unfortunately, you know, I see it in Congress every day that, you know, the Republicans who are left, who are willing to tell the truth, are willing to speak up and stand for our democracy, are being pushed out, by the Trumpist faction of the Republican Party and by Donald Trump himself. And it's very concerning. You know, we need, for our democracy to survive, we need two parties that believe in democracy and the rule of law. And we need people who are willing to admit when they've lost an election. And I give great credit to, you know, the vast majority of Republican candidates in the last election cycle who did not do what Donald Trump did. And when they lost, they admitted it and did the right thing. But we cannot normalize what Donald Trump is doing. And what is, I think, particularly concerning is that so many elected Republicans who know the truth, who know that Joe Biden won the election and there was not widespread voter fraud, they don't have the courage to just say it. And that's what's so dangerous. Mitt Romney, you know, is a principled conservative Republican who, you know, right from the beginning, it was clear about the fact that Joe Biden won. And what he said, I think, was absolutely right. It's, you know, elected officials who, you know, worry about the conspiracy theory wing of the Republican electorate, the best way to show respect for the voters is to tell them the truth. That's what Mitt Romney said. Tell people the truth. And unfortunately, too many of my Republican colleagues in Congress aren't willing to do that. And that's why we have this problem.
It really is just a mind-blowing situation that I personally never thought we'd get to. I mean, we both grew up in this area. I remember as a kid, you get home from school, turn on the TV, watch the Boston News Channel 5 or something like that, and you'd see Mitt Romney at that point in time. And so I kind of grew up with Mitt Romney, and you realize this is a different flavor. Again, probably disagree on most fundamental issues, but the project of American democracy was never in question. That was never part of the flavor.
Right.
And somehow we've branched out into this tributary version of what conservatives seem to be aligned behind. As you said, most people probably don't have that sort of conspiracy-oriented mindset. But nonetheless, it's almost a tyranny of the minority, and it's really dangerous.
Yeah, very dangerous, and we need to be vigilant about it. And by the way, that's one of the reasons that this year's election is so important. We cannot have, you know, another Donald Trump presidency when he has shown that he doesn't respect the rule of law, he doesn't respect the truth, he thinks he's above the law, and he's not willing to accept the peaceful transfer of power and the will of the voters. It would be incredibly dangerous for him to get back into power. And so, you know, we've got a lot of work to do to make sure that people turn out and vote again and understand the stakes here. Our democracy is at stake.
Absolutely. You're sponsoring legislation that would implement pay time off really for all American workers. It's something that's so fundamental. And traveling the world, you see in other places that even 2 weeks is hardly that much of an extreme. Talk about the inspiration for that legislative work.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this bill. We introduced it last week. And for me, the bottom line is this. American workers are the most productive and some of the hardest working people in the world. We have a culture of hard work in the United States, and that's a good thing. But workers deserve to take a break, too, and deserve to have some time off. And 27 million American workers do not get any paid time off at work at all. No surprise, it skews lower income, food service, hospitality, et cetera. But 27 million people who don't get any days off. In Europe, every single country in Europe guarantees at least 20 days off, and some guarantee 30 a year. In the United States, we guarantee zero. So I was frankly a little surprised that this bill had not been introduced in the House before. But our bill would guarantee all American full-time workers at least 10 days a year off. And it can be 10 days, you know, for any reason. You know, it can be to take care of a loved one or go to the doctor, or it could be because your car broke down or because you just want to take a break. And that's okay. Like, we want to normalize that it's okay to take a break sometimes and, you know, have a mental health day. And so 10 days is our bill. We're coming out of the gate with a lot of support. We've got more than 40 co-sponsors already in the House, even though we just introduced it last week. We've got a number of big name organizations that have endorsed it. A Senate version is being introduced soon. So we're excited about it, and we're going to work hard to try to get it done.
I mean, a break is so essential. Anybody who's had intense work, whether it's on the labor side or if it's on any version of work, it doesn't make any difference. There's a productivity drop off that's provable, that's documented, and it is essential. And really, it's the right thing to do. It's also based on the concept of what the American project is. It's essential. You need to have people at their peak, and you can't be at your peak if you're burnt out. That's just a fact.
Totally. It'll actually, I think, improve productivity if you let people have a day off every once in a while to recharge, refresh. That's hugely important. And also, you know, what do we work so hard for? Like, we work so hard because, you know, we want our lives to be better and more fulfilling. And you got to give people the time to live their best lives every once in a while.
Absolutely. Locally, the Washington Bridge remains stories number one, two, and three, and really on a day in, day out basis. It will stay that way for quite some time. You were here last week with Secretary Buttigieg in a couple of different events. Just your general assessment right now, obviously not necessarily in your purview in terms of district-wide, but this is a super regional challenge that's going to impact everyone from Cape Cod through possibly New York for a long time to come. Your takeaways on what can be done?
Yeah, it's incredibly frustrating. It's incredibly frustrating for commuters, for small businesses in the area, even for people who need to get to the hospital. You know, when Secretary Buttigieg came, that was one of the points I made to him, is that, you know, we've got three emergency rooms in Providence and all three of them are on the same side of the bridge. It's a real problem. What I can say is that the federal delegation, myself, Senator Reid, Senator Whitehouse, and Congressman Amo, we are going to work together to get every dollar we possibly can to fund the replacement of that bridge and to get that money as soon as possible. We're waiting on some more information from the state before we can make that full court press for funding. We need to know a little bit more about the scope of the project, the cost of the project. But as soon as we have that information, we will spring into action and pull every piece of leverage that we have in Washington to get that funding. The other thing that I'm focusing on with regard to the bridge is pushing the SBA to do more and to do more faster to help small businesses in the area. I have heard from so many small businesses, both on the East Providence side and the Providence side, whose revenue has collapsed. And, you know, the SBA has a loan program. It's not great, but it's something. But they've been very slow to approve even those applications. And so I'm going to be very vocal, putting pressure on the SBA to do everything they can to streamline that program and to see if they can find other assistance to offer to those small businesses as well.
What's been really upsetting with this from a business standpoint, I spoke with a small business that during COVID, basically because they were in the live event, restaurant, and nightlife space, they're based in Warren. They had to shut down, of course. Obviously, we all did, but they adapted and transformed their business from one thing into another. And I don't want to give too much information so as to not expose who this person is necessarily, but they completely reinvented their business to a walk-up type of model. And in tandem with PPP and other opportunities for just straight cash, were able to survive the pandemic and then grow once we got to a point where the reopening phases were implemented. Now, that very same business down in Warren, their customer base psychologically has been cut off from Providence, a huge portion of their customer base, and there is no adaptation, and there are no cash infusions coming.
Yeah.
They're holding on for dear life. So you're hearing stories like this time and time again, boy, how frustrating to make it through COVID with a ton of adaptation and now be faced with a years minimum long challenge. Can they survive it? Probably not. Huge.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to push the SBA. I'm going to push the SBA to do everything they can to help these businesses. And you know, it's not just, you know, loans or you know, that sort of direct financial infusion. It's also, you know, can we get some funding for marketing? Can we find some ways to help, you know, remind Rhode Islanders that these businesses are still there, they're great, and they're still accessible. And, you know, I think we need to really drill in on this. And, you know, the state and locals have a role to play here, but I'm going to do everything that I can at the federal level as well.
All eyes on the restriping of the eastbound bypass, hopefully when it goes from 2 to 3 lanes, even at a slow motor vehicle pace, that'll open up things psychologically. Congressman Magaziner, as always, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Half Street Group brings a new generation's perspective to leadership communications, strategic public relations, and digital marketing. Half Street helps organizations and leaders take control of their own stories and manage their reputations. They get results for their clients by focusing on audience, message, and culture, and by leveraging their decade-long relationship with media and opinion leaders in the Ocean State and throughout New England. Join me and Half Street Group founder and president Mike Rea for a conversation every month about news of the day, the hottest media analysis, and a look behind the scenes at how impactful leaders drive conversations. Learn more at halfstreetgroup.com.